Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Honourable judges, excellencies, colleagues and friends, firstly my sincere thanks to the organisers of this conference, Professors Bergsma and Sinha, for the privilege of addressing you here today. It's been a wonderful opportunity to reflect a lot more profoundly than what I'm used to doing on crimes against humanity. I am going to firstly locate my presentation sort of squarely within this panel, along the lines of how Professor Anas Stoshopoulou has introduced the notion of collective legal goods. Then having heard from Ms. Song in terms of the particularities of the legal goods protected by crimes against humanity, by war crimes rather, I'm going to then turn to the specificity of the legal goods allegedly protected by crimes against humanity. I'm going to take a somewhat different approach to my predecessor in the sense that I'll be looking more closely at the norms generically that underlie crimes against humanity, and in particular I'm going to critique the notion of whether humanity as such is an underlying legal good. An alternative approach would have been also to enumerate the legal goods protected by the specific legal crimes criminalized by crimes against humanity, but as those crimes substantially reflect crimes under national law, namely murder, rape, the legal goods protected therein don't differ fundamentally. However, the notion of crimes against humanity as a whole, the legal goods that are specific to that offence are distinct from the component crimes that that we could look at. Let us return to perhaps the foundations of this session. As our first speaker has very ably presented, there's a general rationale for the identification of legal goods underlying international crimes. Firstly, it may assist in identifying the basis and thus the scope for future developments of core international crimes in a far more principled way than we've perhaps hitherto done. It may aid us in answering questions such as what sort of conduct we may legitimately criminalise on the international plane. Identification of underlying legal goods is arguably necessary because we are talking here of, at the end of the day, criminalisation rather than mere moral condemnation. But while necessary, it is arguably insufficient as a condition to identify the basis of such criminalisation. And related to this is also notions of harm, whether actual or potential, to the interests protected or the individuals so harmed by the conduct in question. Similar to the general concept of legal goods identified in the first session, we will see over the course of the presentation that humanity as a candidate legal good, if you like, may also reflect both collective and individual interests. And finally, and as we saw in the opening session, and as much as there is a risk of over-dogmatizing, if one likes, the notion of a collective or individual goods, I think that risk inheres in the enterprise I'm undertaking today as well, with the added possibility of a risk of inadvertently transposing essentially municipal law conceptions into international crimes. But let me turn now to humanity as a legal good allegedly protected by crimes against humanity. I'm going to now just provide a schema and an overview of where my presentation will head. I'm going to essentially what is asked over the course of this presentation is, can humanity be regarded as the distinctive legal good protected by crimes against humanity, and if so, how? In this regard, there are a number of potential candidates for admission to the exalted realm of the legal goods protected by crimes against humanity. We could look at human dignity. We could look at international peace and security. As among all of the candidates in this category, humanity has much to recommend it, particularly for several reasons. I think firstly, if situating crimes against humanity contextually vis-a-vis other grave international crimes, the notion of aggression or crimes against peace is perhaps more logically correlated with international peace. And while crimes against humanity may certainly also have externalities that impact on international peace and security, it's arguably not innately a component of a crime against humanity. Human dignity is certainly also brought into question in relation to any crime against humanity that I can think of, but it arguably adheres in any legal concept, grave crime. I don't think it's inherent or unique to crimes against humanity. We'll see also that the notion of humanity is not self-defining, and so the generalized risks regarding abstraction and theory and or imprecision in practice probably in here. We'll also look at some of the thinkers to date that have thought more carefully about the legal goods protected by crimes against humanity. And my essential thesis here is that while they do an admirable job in taking us quite a long way and certainly expanding my conceptions of the underlying legal goods protected by crimes against humanity, it is nonetheless still possible to identify a number of normative gaps and missed opportunities that I think can be fully explored. And these helpfully pick up a number of themes that other speakers have very ably canvassed over the course of the seminar to date. Well, let's start with some essential definitions of crimes against humanity. Fairly much every, both the basic dictionary definition of crimes against humanity and the handful of articles that I'm going to refer in the course of my presentation all identify at least two layers, if not three, of humanity. The first is human. The notion of humanity connotes this idea of human beings collectively, the human race, humankind. But it also has a more abstract connotation of the state, quality, or condition of being human. Additionally, it refers to the quality of humanity, the characteristic, the virtue of being humane. Here, I'm going to attempt to focus our minds on legal notions of humanity. And the notion of humanity is embodied in legal instruments, including some that were precursors to the first expression of crimes against humanity in positive law at Nuremberg, and in particular the fabled Martin's Clause, which refers to the dictates of humanity and public conscience. So I think there are possibly synonymous concepts such as the interests of humanity, laws of humanity, dictates of humanity, etc., which have legal or at least quasi-legal implications. I think the notion of the exact juridical status of the Martin's Clause is the subject of long debate. These concepts do now have at least a crystallizing legal conception. Nonetheless, I think moral ideas, and while moral condemnation as such is not directly relevant to criminalization, I don't think it need be entirely discarded as well, in the sense that notions of what is morally permissible or impermissible necessarily precedes decisions on what ought properly be criminalized. My overall sense is that notions of humanity as a core legal good for crimes against humanity is necessarily an interdisciplinary exercise, and it was one feature I particularly enjoyed in preparing for this seminar is delving into a limited amount of political philosophy and philosophy more generally. Richard Vernon, for example, picks up on this idea that notions of moral and legal sanction are not mutually exclusive and may even be interrelated. For after all, the very idea of a crime against humanity expressed a sense of moral outrage before it became an international offense. That is, it was a wrong before a law could be contrived to condemn it. Let's look now at some of the theoretical treatment to date at of what is the fundamental legal good protected by crimes against humanity. The main point here is that it's received surprisingly little theoretical attention. Even political philosophers have tended to ignore it, with a few notable exceptions, Hannah Arendt being one, and more recently Richard Vernon. Legally, it's in terms of international criminal lawyers, it's received even less attention. The principal focus of my presentation here are on two scholars that have made an impressive attempt to unpack this idea. In particular, David Lubin's Theory of Crimes Against Humanity in the Yale Law Journal of 2004, and to a lesser extent, Kai Ambos's Overall Function of International Criminal Law. Now, how did these scholars treat the underlying legal good protected by crimes against humanity? Interestingly, Lubin in particular does identify humanity as the legal good protected, whereas Ambos is open to a wider list of categories. So for the remainder of the lecture, I'm going to focus in on the notion of whether humanity can withstand scrutiny as the underlying legal good protected by crimes against humanity. In this regard, Lubin, in common with the other thinkers, utilizes the double meaning of humanity in terms of both our individual humanness, but also the aggregation of all human beings, that is, humankind. The essential value injured by crimes against humanity, in Lubin's view, is our humanness. Crimes against humanity offend against our humanness in ways that crimes against peace offend against peace. But how? And what does that actually mean? And there is a number of intellectual progressions through which he takes us, which I think are worthwhile to canvass briefly, before turning to a gentle critique of these ideas and some suggestions for where they could be further developed. The first point is that to note is that crimes against humanity are universally odious because they injure something fundamental to being human. I put in parentheses here the note that they do this in a way that municipal legal systems fail to address. And the reason I put that parenthetically is that that is simultaneously an observation made about the underlying legal goods protected by crimes against humanity, but it's also a jurisdictional trigger, of course, and a kind of constraint over what a crime against humanity is. And Kai Ambos, in his presentation, indicates that it's quite difficult in practice to perfectly tease out what an underlying legal good of crimes against humanity is and a mere component of crimes against humanity, and also the secondary function that legal goods might assist in us in resolving, such as the question of when it's appropriate to criminalize conduct internationally at all. But so we can agree that crimes against humanity are universally odious in a way of injuring something fundamental to our notions of being human. But what is this something? Well, the first thing that Lubin does is exclude some candidates in this heading. There are some things for which the notion of humanity is not for this purpose. The first issue excluded is the notion of human diversity. That the notion of being human in this regard cannot be, the idea of targeting of a human group and the focus on the persecution of an individual because of his or her group identity is far too reductive for the purposes of crimes against humanity. It doesn't express our essential humanness. And in fact, the targeting of individuals qua their group characteristics is in fact the dehumanizing quality that it attaches to crimes against humanity. This may be distinct from the crime of genocide, which is perhaps a far better protection of human diversity. The other thing that Lubin is very leery of are conceptions of human nature itself, this notion of what makes us human? What is our human essence? And he's somewhat coy on this point. He says, well, look, I can't really talk about Judeo-Christian notions of humanity in this regard, of human beings being made in the image of God and these conceptions. We need something of far more universal appeal. And so too do political philosophers shy away from this concept, so it can't be that. He also mentions, and I'll refer to this just in passing, a critique of his own theories here, which is the so-called demonization critique, that if we have a notion of crimes against humanity, we're criminalizing and morally condemning conduct of the most odious nature. We need to guard against falling into the trap of dehumanizing the perpetrators of crimes against humanity, and thereby denying them the sort of sense of human regard that we think should extend to all humanity. And I'm not going to develop this, but I'm going to return to it later because I think it has a lot of resonance with an earlier presentation. So this is what humanity is not. Then what does he think is the underlying legal good that we can all universally agree on is protected by crimes against humanity? And the idea he comes up with has a certain intuitive appeal. And this is the notion that what we all share as human beings is inevitably we must live in a certain place. We have a geographical specificity, and when we live in it, we're forced to live in a certain place, we're usually subjected to forms of authority, be it political or otherwise. So the risk that we all share in that is that the polity under which our lives are governed may basically become cancerous, in his view, may ultimately distort the notion of sovereignty altogether, and it, rather than being a protective force, turn and actually target human populations that are subjected to it. This he contends is something that a vulnerability that we all share, a universal fear that we all have, and a collective interest that we can all agree to combat. So this notion of crime against, and this is shared in the works of Vernon, this notion of a crime against humanity is some sort of moral inversion or travesty of the state, which occurs when the essential resources of the state are put to malign use. So this returns to this idea that crimes against humanity, one intrinsic feature of it is that they are often committed by states against civilians within their borders. And this subsidiarily also provides a justification for overriding state sovereignty and subjecting these crimes to international criminalization. So it serves the double goal of being a jurisdictional constraint, as a jurisdictional demarcator as well. The other concept that is shared in all of these writings is the notion of gravity, that crimes against humanity have added dimensions of extreme cruelty, barbarism, odiousness, severity. While in practice few have lost sleep over the idea of the enormity of Nazi atrocities, for example, the notion of gravity nonetheless has innate problems of ambiguity. I mean, what level of cruelty is extreme? Methodological problems of how one measures cruelty and severity, and also a degree of repugnance in so doing. There's this odious moral. There's the notion of a body count in order for victimization to reach a level of adequacy really does debase the whole notion of international criminal law to a serious degree. Okay, what is my evaluation and tentative conclusions over whether humanity as so defined can serve as the legal good protected by crimes against humanity? I have a number of conclusions which I'm just going to summarize. The first is that I think identifying core values protected by crimes against humanity is a useful exercise. But I think it has the same general risk as with any candidate legal norm identified, that one can define it so generally and so blandly that it's effectively empty as an analytical category, or it has a level of specificity that is contentious and therefore not able to be universally shared. While I think humanity is a useful starting point, I think it's not a self-explanatory concept. And I think the notion of incrementalism is never going to disappear from international criminal law. even if we can agree on the legal norms on the legal goods protected, because we will always have concrete problems to overcome. It will also not on its own solve the issue of the proper scope of international crimes. Even if we can agree that the underlying legal good protected is humanity, it doesn't innately answer the question of whether the present categories of crimes against humanity could be extended. Does that exclude terrorism, or does that instead suggest that terrorism should be protected in a separate, discrete, distinct crime? That might shed light on that question, but it doesn't resolve that question. There's also, as mentioned, a number of normative gaps in the few but very impressive enumerations that I've mentioned to date, and I'm just going to list them and not elaborate them. I think that notions of international notions of human nature and society actually have at their heart ideas both of international political organization as well as conceptions of human nature. I was particularly influenced by Philip Allott's idea that law cannot be better than the society it serves. And that in turn means, what is this society? And more specifically, what is the nature of the individuals that comprise it? And it's not one part of our interrogation here. Essentially, these rather negative notions that we carry with us about conceptions of human nature itself. And we had an earlier presentation that focused on this Gandhian notion of criminality as a disease of the human spirit. Are crimes against humanity an affront to these realities of the human spirit? And may similar conceptions be useful also in relation to Lubin's concern not to demonize perpetrators of crimes against humanity? Finally, I think there's an excessively statist focus within this analysis that has a lot of internal logic, but it arguably fails even the threshold test of an accurate description of crimes against humanity as currently understood. I think crimes against humanity as essentially crimes where sovereignty is distorted and state resources brought to bear is a component of this, but I don't think the crimes of ISIS, for example, are arguably not the emanations of a statist entity controlling territory. It's if sovereignty becomes cancerous in Lubin's vision, this is metastases of a cancer that has spread through far more diffuse means. Also, this notion of unconditional wrongness. What does that tell us about current critiques about the selectivity of international criminal justice and endorsement of the withdrawal or even abstaining from the ICC on this basis? That is a very weak commitment to these very underlying and powerful notions of unconditional wrongness and odiousness. Also, does it not fetishize the interests of states? This essentially Hobbesian conception, which now should arguably give way to broader conceptions of international legal order. And I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.